Thank you, David, for your kind introductory comments and for so completely summarising my talk. And thank you to CEDA for hosting this this luncheon, and thank you all for dignifying me with your attendance and your interest. If I were to frame the context for this presentation and for the debate, it would be as follows, and that is the global demand for electricity continues to grow strongly, and the figures vary, but it's about 2% growth per year on the back of economic growth in countries around the world and rising prosperity in countries that aspire to our levels of our standard of living. And in Australia's case, our use of electricity is likely to double sometime between 2040 and 2050 relative to what it is today, notwithstanding the best efforts and the sincere efforts of people to conserve energy and to use electricity, power, etc., more wisely. So we are in an environment globally and domestically of increasing demand for electricity and for energy in general. But we're also in an environment where people are genuinely concerned about climate change and broadly have now accepted that climate change is basically around global warming. Global warming is connected to the accumulating concentration of greenhouse gases in the stratosphere, and greenhouse gas emissions come from the burning of fossil fuel, coal, gas, oil, petrol, wood, etc. So with 90% of the world's electricity being powered by fossil fuels, and Australia's electricity, also about 90% comes from gas and coal, how does one get on top of greenhouse gas emissions while at the same time acknowledging that we are going to have to invest more and more in additional electricity capacity to meet the needs of industry, the national economy, and our aspirations for continuing growth in our prosperity? Now, in anticipation of the importance of nuclear power in that discussion, the government set up this task force in the middle of last year to revisit the issue of nuclear power, and the mandate here was not to produce a report, an expert report, that would be an advocate of nuclear-powered electricity for Australia. Rather, it recognised that there had been in Australia, for the better part of 20 years, a moratorium, arguably a pause, in the discussion of everything to do with the nuclear power cycle. It happened in the early 1980s with the capping of additional uranium mining in Australia, and it's been limited to the existing three mines since that period of time. And it coincided with really a worldwide reaction to concerns about nuclear power on the back of Three Mile Island, which happened in 1979, and Chernobyl, which happened in 1986. So you can't in this country step from 20 years of inactivity in this area at a policy and a practical level to making decisions. We have to engage in a process where the broader community has to be informed as to what the latest thinking is about the nuclear fuel cycle. We have to share the experiences with Australians of overseas countries, maybe paint some potential scenarios. But as a task force, we tried really hard not to be in a position to be seen as advocates of nuclear power. And I don't stand in front of you this afternoon being a representative of the interests of the nuclear power industry, or necessarily being in a position to argue that that is the answer, although you'll find at the end of all this, you'll sense my conviction that nuclear energy needs to be part of our thinking in the decades ahead. So our mandate was to inform the public debate. The metric for success for me is that we have the discussion, that the discussion is based upon data and is objective, and I would say the experience of the last few months suggests that we're making some progress in that area. With respect to the review, let me just get to the findings, because I think the process is now well documented. We were asked to focus on four areas, uranium mining, the value-adding steps, nuclear power, and issues of waste and proliferation. On uranium mining, we visited Australia's three mines, formed the views that Australian miners are operated in a very sophisticated way. The processes used were world-class. The attention to safety and radiation exposure management were good. And at the industry itself, there was growing demand for uranium now and is expected into the future. Prices are high, extraordinarily so, with forecasts that they might go higher still. And there's no doubt around the world the utilities that buy uranium love dealing with Australian suppliers because they know we are a compliant country in terms of the various international treaties and that we are dependable, reliable, high-quality providers of the raw materials. So we formed the view that there was no reason for government and the Australian people to stand in the way of further development of our uranium assets. And as David indicated in his introductory comments, we have a lot of them, even though for 20 years there's been largely hardly any prospecting for uranium because of the limitations around mining, and that's changed in recent times. So we say big tick, uranium mining and export should be allowed to go ahead unencumbered by restrictions. And my sense is, from what the reports of the Australian Labor Party are, is that when the ALP have their national convention in April this year, the leadership have foreshadowed for some time that they would be revisiting the ALP objections to this with a view to reversing their position. And it may well be that this will be the first aspect of the nuclear fuel cycle which sees bipartisan support for lifting the restrictions on uranium mining in Australia. In terms of value-added processing, what that means is you take the yellow cake uranium oxide and you take it through its various steps whereby you enrich the fissionable isotope and then you convert the enriched material into fuel rods which you can then insert into the reactors around the world. There are a number of groups around the country that believe that there are serious business opportunities available here for Australian companies. We looked at the steps. We've visited conversion and enrichment and fuel fabrication facilities around the world. And we acknowledge this is an interesting business. If our export revenues of uranium today are about $1 billion a year, then the value added, if you enriched and fabricated all of that uranium, which is a sort of a hypothetical situation, you're looking at probably another couple of $1 billion of revenues with reasonable returns. In reality, the key value-adding step is that of enrichment. It's a very sophisticated technology. It is closely held by two or three companies around the world. There is plenty of enrichment capacity available at this stage. And enrichment takes you from dealing with comparatively benign uranium to much more contentious enriched uranium, which causes or necessitates a much higher level of oversight, scrutiny and compliance to international treaties. And again, we concluded there is probably no role for government here to get in the way of business, considering business cases to get involved in value-adding steps, other than to provide for an appropriate regulatory regime. On the other hand, we felt that the business case to justify a $2 or $3 billion investment in an enrichment plant where the intellectual property was hard to get and where Australia had no compelling argument to site a plant in Australia to supply reactors that were everywhere else other than Australia, we felt the business case would be difficult to make, and we didn't feel that there would be a lot of companies that would come forward with proposals to get involved in value-adding steps. But again, we didn't feel that we needed to make that decision. We just needed to create the right environment for within which business could operate. On the matter of nuclear power, as David said in his introductory comments, there are already 31 countries and 440 reactors out there. It's 15% of the world's electricity, but if you went to the OECD countries, there's 23% of the electricity that the OECD countries generate comes from nuclear sources. So about half of what they get from coal, they now produce with nuclear. So it's kind of interesting when you travel around the world and you discuss with these nuclear-powered countries Australia's thinking, they're a bit perplexed as to why we find it hard to take that step to go all the way to nuclear electricity, because for them it's turned out to be clean, it's efficient, the technology is reliable, it's now off the shelf, and most of the historic issues associated with the management of the spent fuel rods, etc., are now believed to lend themselves to relatively straightforward engineering solutions. There are about 8 additional countries in the queue to introduce nuclear power. There are, I think, about 60 reactors on order around the world and another couple of hundred being planned to add to the 443 that are out there at the moment. However, for Australia, we made the following observations. Compared to our fossil fuel-powered electricity. Nuclear today would be more expensive at the generator level. You can almost pick your number because there are so many different ways of looking at this and so many different studies. But between 20 and 50% more expensive at the generation stage, which is about a third of the total cost of delivering electricity to your home or to your business, would be more costly if you went to nuclear today. If the country formed the view that we wanted to introduce the first nuclear reactor and we decided that today, then the first reactor probably would not appear for another 15 years because we are starting from arguably behind scratch. Now, since we've issued the report, some people have said, well, 15 years sounds too long. You can do it faster than that. The French in 15 years went from zero reactors to 59 reactors and 80% of the electricity is nuclear. So a national strategy obsessively focused on a particular technology could get you there. But given where we are in our with our community attitudes and the last absence of any debate over the last 20 years, 15 years sounded reasonable to us. Other people have said, no, it'll take a lot longer than that. It could take 20 or more years. And frankly, there are arguments to be made at both ends of the spectrum. We took the view that really you should plan on about a 15-year progression. And also for the very first reactor, and we saw evidence of this last week with the announcement, or at least the media coverage of the apparent interest on the part of Messrs. De Crespigny, Morgan and Walker in the first reactor, that the first reactor is going to require very special handling, and it's unclear whether you can build a first reactor in Australia without a lot of government involvement. When we travelled around the world, we tried to find a nuclear-powered country that had its civilian nuclear electricity start without government intervention or government support, and we couldn't find such a country. Many countries have got involved in nuclear power on the back of a military program from the Second World War. Others have had their national energy utilities make the first investments, but they have been government-owned utilities. So you've got to acknowledge that the first reactor is going to require an appropriate regulatory regime, and in the absence of a bipartisan policy environment in Australia, and there's no evidence that we'll get that, it's going to need some degree of government assurance in order to make that business decision feasible. And that's part of the debate we still have to have in the months and years ahead. In the area of waste and catastrophic accidents like Chernobyl and concerns about proliferation, just the shorthand in all of this was that while there is no repository yet operating for the management of high-level, long-lived nuclear waste, the solutions for the storing of that waste are now in hand. And half a dozen countries around the world are building long-term repositories, which basically will be deep wells, not deep by mining standards, but 500 metres or so deep, in a geologically stable environment, into which will be deposited spent fuel rods that will have been encapsulated in glass or in concrete after they had been removed from a reactor and allowed to cool down over a number of years. While waste remains emotional, if you get into this topic and if you get a chance to visit a nuclear facility and observe the way the spent fuel rods are managed out of a reactor into a cooling pond, into dry storage, into a long-term storage process, you are actually remarkably reassured. The long-lived waste is, by the time it gets put into storage, comparatively benign. It has to be handled fairly carefully, but you can approach it. You can these dry storage facilities are a couple of metres across. They're silos of 3 or 4 metres height. You can work in their environment. You can touch it. You probably wouldn't want to live within a metre of it for long periods of time. But even then, but in terms of incremental exposure from the radiation that's residual after 10 or 20 years of cooling down, it's relatively small. And in the pantheon of toxic materials that we as a society have learned to handle, the toxicity of all of this is, I've got to say, relatively minor. Similarly, introducing a reactor into the Australian energy grid, we judged, would not make the energy grid more vulnerable to mischief. Arguably, these reactors are engineered in such a way that you would need either a very misguided terrorist or a very, 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 very well-informed and well-resourced group to get anywhere to the point where it would cause minor discomfort to the system. And in terms of the Chernobyl-type experience, which I've got to say was a serious event of great continuing traumatic consequence to the Ukrainian and Belarus and Russian societies, today more psychological and economic than physical. The reactors that characterised the Soviet system of the 70s and 80s would not have been accredited in the West, and decisions that Australia will need to make about reactors going forward would be on the basis of technologies that we observe today and which are and have been proven to be remarkably robust and reliable. And while nothing that we do is absolutely risk-free and you therefore can't give assurances about the absence of risk or that there's zero risk, the fact is that modern reactors are now designed. We were told, frankly, that if you spent $3 billion, as you would in Australia, on a reactor, about half of that money goes into safety systems that you hope will never be activated. So the designs are such as to have layers upon layers of protections against all sorts of possible variances and departures from normal operating procedures. That are designed to reassure the communities that use these reactors as to the very, very low and arguably acceptable risk that reactors would pose. In our report, we thought we should paint some scenarios. These are not recommendations, nor are they suggestions that this is the proper mix. But we've said that if you started building with your first reactor ready in 2020-ish, your second reactor would be built some years after you were confident that the first reactor had met all of the requirements and the expectations that you had in place with the business plan and community commitments. And then you built a reactor pretty much every year thereafter, which would be about as much as you could in Australia. Then you'd have about 25 reactors by 2050, and they would be providing about a third of Australia's electricity. Now, there's about eight countries which already have more than a third of their electricity being nuclear-powered, and by 2050 you'll probably have, if Australia were to reach that point, we'd be perhaps one of 50 countries that will have reached that point. From that you can deduce that the contribution that nuclear power could make to our energy generation is important, but it can't possibly be the only thing this country does in grappling both with its long-term energy needs and its near and long-term climate change strategy. So we've used language such as to recommend that nuclear energy be seriously considered in the energy strategy and the climate change strategy of the country, but it is not of its own capable of solving most of our issues. Arguably, it'll be one of many things that we have to do to properly transition through the next couple of generations. Let me draw your attention to what I think are a couple of shifts in the community that we've observed in the last 9 months. When we started on the nuclear review in June, July of last year, the topic of climate change was out there in the broader community, but it was hardly the headline. It had hardly the headline status that it has today. Our mandate was very focused on the nuclear fuel cycle, and we tried quite hard not to opine about matters to do with climate change, or in fact get distracted and spend a lot of time explaining what greenhouse gas signatures were like in this country, etc. The fact of the matter is that the much more important issue for this country is to form a view about climate change, greenhouse gases, and what Australia wants to do by way of contributing to that debate. And having formed that view, which I think is well progressed in terms of the debate thus far, then you turn to, and of all of the levers we can pull, Is nuclear one of them? And our response to that will be is that it probably should be one of the things that we consider. So climate change has come out of or come from a position of being interesting, and some far-sighted people were aware of it for quite some time in Australia, to being probably the topic of the moment as I speak to you, without diminishing that there are three or four other big issues in front of this country at any one period of time. Climate change is the larger issue, and it's obviously occupying a lot of media attention and thinking on the part of policymakers. Specifically with respect to nuclear, in June, when I looked at the submissions that were made to the inquiry and talked to communities like this, the main concerns expressed by the opponents to nuclear power were concerns about the long-lived toxic nature of nuclear waste, worries about the occurrence of a catastrophic Chernobyl-like accident, and issues to do with terrorism, proliferation, etc. Today, those issues are still there, but frankly, the debate has seen other issues overtake them, surprisingly to some extent, given that only a short number of months have elapsed, and not because of our inquiry, but perhaps influenced a little bit by the discussions that we've caused to happen in recent months. Today, when I go around, broadly the challenges put in front of me are nuclear power is too costly, nuclear power takes too long to make a difference, and you haven't confronted the issue of where you're going to put these reactors. Now, that's quite an interesting shift, because it represents a shift in my mind from a community concerned about issues based upon the experience of the early stages of the industry and the accidents of the 70s and the 80s, sincerely held, deeply emotional views, to relatively straightforward business and commercial considerations. If nuclear power is indeed too costly, if it takes too long to make a difference, if the environmental and community approvals cannot be reached in terms of where they are to be located, then it won't happen. It's a basically rational debate that increasingly this sort of topic appears to be attracting. Now, what I should have emphasised early on when I mentioned climate change is that it's now broadly accepted that there is an inevitability that Australia, along with other countries around the world, will put a price on our pollution and our emissions. Whether it's a direct tax on carbon emissions or whether it's some cap and trade framework to govern carbon dioxide emissions and progressively to motivate, incent the right kinds of behaviours, there will be some cost associated with carbon. If you make even reasonable judgments in terms of what a moderate cost would be for carbon dioxide, all of a sudden the cost differentials between coal and gas and nuclear disappear, and between wind as well, and then progressively also make every other form of energy, renewables, etc., much more cost competitive. So if you accept that there will be a cost for carbon, and I say that that's the way the wind is blowing at the moment, then every other form of energy becomes interesting. At the same time, if you plan for a future with some form of cost for carbon, and then you say, what are the alternatives in terms of electricity generation for the baseload? Because 80% of electricity has to be available all of the time. It cannot be subject to the intermittent nature of the wind blowing or the sun shining. Then what alternative do you have other than coal and gas? Well, hydroelectric would be an alternative, but it is already fully deployed. The only alternative available to Australia is nuclear power. Now, this is a controversial conclusion, because as you will have found, including some of the people outside the hotel this afternoon, there are people with very firm convictions that wind and solar and tidal power and waves and geothermal are all going to be capable of stepping up and making a big contribution. And my response to that is I certainly hope that's true, And whatever we do should set up a framework to provide as much encouragement for the development of those technologies as for nuclear, if in fact that's the inclination of the country and its policymakers. But on the basis of what we know today, because of the intermittent nature of those technologies, you cannot plan to incorporate them to support the baseload needs of Australia. You must look to the conventional alternatives, which, as I say, in Australia's case is either more coal and gas in a cleaner environment and nuclear. Now, there will be some amongst you that will find that an uncomfortable conclusion, and you will point to other things that we might do. But let me remind you again of what you could do if you wanted to intervene in reducing the greenhouse gas signature of this country. Firstly, what you should do is stop population growth. Now, I'm not suggesting this seriously, but in order, as is my role, to help inform the debate or provoke you into thinking outside the square, that's one thing you could do. That would certainly reduce the growth in demand for electricity. You could, for example, also stop people deploying air conditioning units, which on their own are the single largest contributor to the growth in electricity demand over the next several decades. So those 54% of the households that have an air conditioner, you're okay. But the other 46%, you shouldn't have one, you know, if you want to be environmentally responsible. You could align with Senator Bob Brown and shut down the coal industry. That would absolutely get rid of greenhouse gas emissions. This is an economy that has grown on the back of cheap energy, cheap coal and gas. Frankly, I think the higher priority is let's find ways to use the resources we have in coal and gas in a way that's more environmentally friendly. My own view is that it should be our number one priority, and that we should find ways to burn coal more effectively and then find ways to capture the emissions from the burning of anything, coal, gas, wood, biomass, etc., and store those emissions in a way as to prevent them from accumulating in the upper atmosphere. Easier said than done. Our review was informed through a number of expert submissions that carbon capture and storage, while an area that's increasingly well-resourced in this country and where a technology where arguably we should lead the world, is filled with potential, but it feels 20 or 30 years away at this stage, which is a long, long time into the future. If you wanted to make a contribution, you would stop driving petrol-driven vehicles, cars and trucks. I mean, half of our emissions come from burning of coal and gas, but probably 20%, 20 maybe a little bit more, comes from cars, transport. You might also become vegetarians, because then we wouldn't need herds of cows and sheep belching methane and carbon dioxide into the upper atmosphere. Turns out to, and just so that you get this, the anatomical precision right, it's the belching that's the problem, not the rear processes. And of course, none of these are things we will seriously contemplate, because we really do want to have an appreciating standard of living, and there are initiatives we can take to both accommodate growth in our improvement in our quality of life, while at the same time becoming an increasingly responsible global citizen. So let me suggest in summary what I think will happen in the year ahead in this debate. The government has before it a number of reports. The nuclear review was one. A report from the uranium industry was another. A report from the parliamentary subcommittee headed up by Jeff Prosser was a third. These reports, I think, are being integrated, and the public service is to inform the government as to the way in which the findings and the recommendations might best play out in a policy sense. We do have 20 years of neglect in terms of investment in skills and training, and universities are beginning to address that now. And the Nuclear Science and Technology Organisation that I now chair has an important role to play there in terms of lifting the skills, contributing to the training, entering into partnership with universities and overseas organisations, so that within two or three undergraduate cycles, say 10 years, we might fill the gaps that we demonstrably have in terms of trained nuclear physicists, radiation chemists, mining engineers, etc. I mentioned the ALP National Convention. The enthusiasm that the stock market has for uranium stocks is evidence that the broader business community believes that uranium mining will be opened up, and that these companies that have licenses or have staked out mines and found uranium resources are going to be very valuable, and I think that's probably a reasonable judgment to have made. We need a regulatory regime to put in place to oversee a national uranium mining industry. I think those steps are straightforward, and as David mentioned in his introductory comments, there are remarkable inconsistencies across each of the states, even though the states are themselves all of the one party. They have approached this issue quite separately. In addition, at the federal level there is an Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act of 1999 that makes it illegal to run an enrichment plant or have a nuclear power reactor. There's a number of changes to the law that would have to be made that we may well see play out this year. And as we were advised by countries around the world, this is a debate that they've had to have that has gone on for 10 and 20 years before they've taken their people from being antagonistic to nuclear power to being very supportive. There are people out there that say, well, we don't have 10 or 20 years to form that view because of the urgency with that climate change is imposing upon our decision-making. If you accept that, it may mean that we will have to make decisions in years rather than in decades. Having said that, we do have years to get the decision right. There is a breathlessness at the moment about climate change that implies we have to make a decision this week, this month, or even this quarter, or this electoral cycle. That is plainly wrong. Climate change is going to happen, is happening over decades. It's much more important for Australia to get the policy settings right and be pointed in the right direction than it is for us to be scrambling around to do a whole lot of things because we feel that it's good to be seen to be doing the right thing. So in conclusion, again to reiterate, our mandate and my position publicly is still, I want to inform the debate. It's not to suggest that nuclear power is the answer, although the evidence points in that direction. Whatever is introduced by way of policy needs to be a level playing field so that if there is some interest in encouraging non-fossil fuel energy in this country, it should apply to all non-fossil fuel alternatives, not just to solar, wind or nuclear or whatever your favourite topic should be. Climate change is important, but the timing should be such that we make thoughtful decisions with a view to the seriously long term in terms of our contribution to the climate change debate. There's a different debate about adjusting to climate change and droughts and water. That's a local set of problems with local solutions that should be in front of us as we speak. But the larger climate change, Australia's climate is hostage to global phenomena. Our strategy needs to be focused upon making a difference globally. Very little that we do domestically is going to make any difference to our climate over a long period of time, but obviously we have to understand the role we play internationally to shape global policy. And with that, might I thank you for your interest and attention, and David, hand back to you and invite questions, challenges or criticisms. Thank you very much.